Well, on the 25th of May, 1647, Parliament voted simply to disband the army without pay. 4 days later, the army struck back. It seized the king from his parliamentary guards and refused to disband until its grievances were met. There's an ironic sense in which the army is taking a position that Parliament itself had taken in 1641, that is to say, seizing power and refusing to disband until its demands have been met. Now, in the army, the initiative for this radical action fairly clearly came from below. It came from the junior officers and from the rank and file. The high command, drawn at least more heavily from members of the older social elite, were more or less carried along by what was going on. By 1647, it's fairly clear that the army had been heavily influenced by the ideas of the levelers. But despite the apparent unity of action in the army, there were nonetheless fairly serious differences of opinion between the high command, whom, as I've said before, were drawn from the pre-war social elite and therefore tended to be conservative, and the junior officers and the common soldiers who had been more influenced by the radical political ideas. Nonetheless, for all these divisions within the army, the rift, or if there even was a potential rift, closed fairly quickly. Because at this point, Charles decided to make a move. He escaped from all of his guards and fled to Scotland. And what ensued then was what's often called the Second English Civil War, lasting between 1647 and 1649. The army, the New Model Army, responded quite quickly to Charles's flight. And in August of 1648, the army defeated those Scottish moderates with whom Charles had allied himself. But the problem was that the renewal of hostilities for the fact that the war seemingly ended, now started again, had truly embittered the army against the king. And when Parliament balked at the idea of bringing Charles to account for starting yet a second war, the army decided to purge Parliament itself. In December of 1648, units were stationed outside Parliament. They were given a list of reliable and unreliable MPs, and only those who were approved were allowed to sit in Parliament. This purging of Parliament, creating what came to be called the Rump Parliament, allowed a radical minority in what had been the Long Parliament to put Charles on trial. He defended himself eloquently, but nevertheless, the Parliament convicted him and would ultimately execute Charles for treason on the 30th of January, 1649. The revolution didn't stop there. In February of 1649, the Rump Parliament abolished both the House of Lords and the monarchy itself, and in place of the monarchy, a republic called the Commonwealth was proclaimed. The Rump Parliament also, interestingly enough, proclaimed itself to be the representative of all of the people. But what needs to be kept in mind at this point is that the Parliament, the Rump Parliament, represented neither a majority of the people in a demographic sense in England, because Parliament never represented all the people given the way it was elected. But the Rump Parliament also didn't represent what we might want to call the majority opinion of the political nation, the views of those people who counted, because since the purge, it was dominated by radicals. What the Rump Parliament represents, above all, is the radical voice of a revolutionary army. And I think the question to consider at this point is who these radicals were and where they came from. The place to start are the years 1640 and 1641, when the abolition of the various church courts and the collapse of public censorship, and indeed especially the Civil War itself, had released a whole set of radical demands which were far removed from the moderate aims, or at least the relatively moderate aims, of the MPs of 1640 to 1642. This is again a common early modern phenomenon in which some kind of rebellion against the monarchy starts off on relatively limited terms and ultimately is radicalized. We've seen this happen in the French Wars of Religion with the emergence of Parisian radicals of the Catholic League in the 1580s and 1590s. We've seen the same thing happen in the Netherlands, where Flemish radicals emerge in Ghent and other towns, forming these radical Calvinist communities of 18, as they're called, in 1577 and 1578. But to go back to England, the ideas of all of these radicals are hard to categorize. It's hard to label them neatly. We can't really divide them easily into economic ideas or social ideas or religious ideas, because individual thinkers move fairly easily from one topic to the other. And so there were fairly wide differences of opinion, even within a particular radical group. Nevertheless, almost all of the radicals were united in extending, albeit radically extending, two key ideas which had long been a part of mainstream Protestantism. The first of these was the idea, or the belief, that God worked really through individuals and not through institutions. This has a long pedigree in Protestantism. You'll recall that Luther insisted that the church itself has no coercive power. It ought not even to be a formal institution in any sense at all, but is just a gathered collection of the believers. In England, during the 1640s,